Chapter 2. System Transport Vessel Primogenia. Outer Terran Approaches. Maecenas came to his feet as the pilot Carder approached the Primogenia's bridge. He had ended his show of sleep when the muster alarm sounded. The seconds remaining in his mental count were vanishing. First attendant Sieur Nell stared at him as he smoothed his hair and arranged his tabard. Contempt bled from her gaze. He smiled back. There was very little about what he was doing that involved anything as petty as spite, but he let himself have a second of pleasure at the thought that he would soon not have to smile at her at all.
"Attend,"
the shipmaster called, as the main doors to the bridge began to open. All the bridge crews stiffened where they stood. Maecenas and Sieur Nell both looked to the shipmaster. He was facing the doors, chin raised and eyes steady, the spun silver of his tabard hanging from his thin frame, the bones of his face sharp beneath his black eyes. Maecenas's silent count flicked through one of its last seconds. The pilot Carder marched onto the bridge, 10 figures in two lines, plasteel armor plating clad their chests, the backs of their arms and shins. Domed pressure helmets covered their heads. On their shoulders, the heraldry of the Saturnine Ram's second solar auxiliar cohort sat on its white and blue field. Maecenas knew their reputation. These were elite troops, raised to do war on ships and void stations. Much of the work of overseeing supply vessels approaching Terra had fallen to them in the last years. A low buzz filled the air as the auxiliaries spread out across the bridge. The arc rings of their Volkite charges were glowing. Last to enter was an officer. The rank chevrons on his shoulder proclaimed him a strategos of the elite Velataris. He held a data slate rather than a weapon, and the visor of his helm was hinged up, exposing a scarred but handsome face. He glanced briefly at the shipmaster.
"You are shipmaster Heisnen Castle on 29?
Said the strategos.
"This vessel is the Primogenia, bonded to the Oberon consanguinity, and bearing mixed cargoes from outer Gulf Station Epiphus under writ and instruction for the supply of Terra."
The strategos looked up. His eyes were pale gold.
"Can you confirm that these details are correct?"
Out of the corner of his eye, Maecenas saw the shipmaster frown. The rivalry and distrust between the Saturnine Ordo and the Jovian Void Clans was as old as the turning of the planets. 2 centuries of alliance under the rule of the Emperor had reduced the rancor between the old enemies, but not removed it.
"I can confirm that the details you've related to me are correct," said the shipmaster, with a stiff bow of his head. "In honor and loyalty, I welcome you on board."
The strategos looked down at his data slate. As he did, his eyes flicked at Maecenas. The mental count of seconds reached 0. The exchange of hand signals looked like nothing.
"Good," said the strategos. He drew and fired his pistol so fast that Maecenas did not have time to blink.
The Volkite beam hit the shipmaster in the chest and reduced him to ashes. Sieur Nell managed to begin a shout before the beam flicked out again. The rest of the troops began firing a second later. It was over within a minute. The communication controllers died first, before their screams had even sounded. The rest followed. The strategos turned to Maecenas as the sound of the last shot faded. A smell of static and burning filled the air.
"We are on schedule?" asked the strategos.
"Yes," replied Maecenas.
He was already moving to the primary engine control.
"The cargo was substituted correctly?"
"Yes, it is exactly as required."
"And the ship's course?"
Maecenas frowned as dials spun under his fingers as he worked the engine controls. Now that he was here, it felt strange. He'd thought that he would feel something more, some form of exaltation. But he felt nothing, just hollow, as though he were about to lose something by finally casting off his false life and beginning anew. He turned another dial and watched as a set of brass hands clicked around to the red segment of an ivory circle set into the helm control. Beneath his feet, he felt a rumble as the Primogenia's engines lit and the ship began to accelerate through the void again.
It's moving, course as before. They will notice something is wrong eventually, but by then it won't matter, the strategos said and nodded.
Good, he said, raised his pistol and fired once.
Lieutenant Maecenas, 5-on-2, managed to open his mouth before his last words were blown to dust. Gobi Toxwaste's terror. The rad wolves leapt into the glare. The light of the melter torches caught the wet sharpness of their teeth. Ms. Medra watched as a rad wolf the size of a horse landed 5 paces away. Scales surrounded rows of red eyes running down the side of its muzzle. The rest of its pack bounded forwards behind it, hunger and instinct driving them towards the light and the smell of flesh. Ms. Medra tilted her head, eyes steady, arms folded. One of the wolves snarled, muscle coiling under iridescent fur, then leapt. The rotor cannon screamed from behind her. The rad wolf became a spray of liquid and meat. A torrent of tracer fire panned across the pack of wolves for a few seconds. Blood lacquered the rocks where the beasts had been.
You want to help next time? Said Nis,
as he stepped up next to her. The exoskeleton, wrapped around the scav boss's torso, hissed as he moved. The barrel of his rotor cannon was still spinning down. The ammo feed leading from the hoppers on his back clinked against his legs.
You know how to use those, right?
He said, nodding at her holstered guns.
If I did that kind of thing myself, what would I be paying you for?
She said, and turned away. The glare of melter torches fizzed in her sight from where the scavengers were cutting into the hard pan. The crawler was drawn up on the other side of the dig site. She could see the silhouette of a figure standing on the vehicle's roof, looking out towards the night on the other side. Like Nis, the sentry was wearing a crude exoskeleton and carrying a serious piece of weaponry. The rad wolves had been coming at them ever since they got out of the crawler. When the scavs had started ripping into the crust layer, even more of them had come.
It's the smell,
Nis had said, once the first 2 packs had been cut down.
I can smell the dust and the burn from the torches. Makes them hungry. Makes them come looking to eat.
She squinted at the excavation. The pit was a ragged bite into the plateau's surface, 20 meters across at its widest point and 5 deep. Rock dust and powdered crystal sprayed up in the glare from the melter beams. The scavs were outlines in the haze. They knew their business, though. She had to give them that. They worked without stopping, and even though they seemed to dig, drill, and cut like starved beasts tearing into food, they were careful. She looked up as Incarnus came to stand beside her, face hidden by the visor of his breathe mask, limbs coated in a dark red body glove. He seemed even more like an insect than normal. He nodded down at the scavs in the pit.
"Yes, they are more precise and careful than you would think from looking at them, aren't they?"
he said, his voice a purr in her skull. She tensed and felt her skin prickle against the inside of her body glove.
"Get out of my head!"
she thought, pouring as much loathing into it as she could. Incarnus laughed, tilting his head back and then shivering. There was something smooth and unpleasant about the movement.
"My apologies,"
he said, still in her mind, and she felt clammy heat crawl over her scalp.
"Anyway, your kind are so dull. So many safeguards and mental cutouts. I would have to do some damage to do anything really interesting."
"Get out,"
she thought carefully.
"Or do you want me to see if I can shoot you before you can stop me reaching my guns?"
He recoiled as though struck.
"You would not dare. The operation."
"You should know that there is always another way, Incarnus. Redundancy. That's how we do things."
He raised a hand, and she heard him take a breath to say something else. A cry rose from the pit. She turned and saw that the glare from the melter beams had dimmed. The scavs were clustering around something still hidden by the curtains of dust and vapor. She stepped forwards and jumped down into the pit. As though conjured up from the air, Ashul was at her side. Incarnus followed a pace behind. The scavs cleared a path as they crossed the bottom of the pit, casting puzzled glances at each other.
"Light!"
she shouted, and a stab beam swung over her as she bent down next to the path of bare metal they had uncovered. She brushed her hands across the dull surface, fingers searching. After a few seconds, she found an edge, and then a corner.
She looked up at Incarnus, ignoring the stares of the scavgangers.
"Is it them?"
she said across their private vox.
"Can't say,"
said Incarnus, who bent down and placed his hand on the flat metal next to hers.
"You can't say," growled Ashul.
"If it is them, they are barely alive,"
Incarnus shrugged, patting the dust from his gauntlets as he stood.
"No thoughts, no dreams, no little sparks of consciousness for me to sense."
Miss Madra looked down at the exposed metal.
"Get this out," she said, her voice loud on the night air. "There should be 9 more close by. Be very careful. Any of them get damaged and you don't get paid. Any of them get destroyed, I have your boss's agreement that half of you die."
They did as she asked. The wolves came 4 more times while the scavs dug, and the rotor cannon chattered into the dark. She did not look around to watch the slaughter. Nis knew his business, and besides, she found she could not look away as the metal blocks emerged from the earth. They found the other 9, one after another, and dug around them until they could lever them out. Eventually, 10 blocks of dull metal sat on the hardpan, studded with bolts and crossed by reinforcement struts. 5 were cubes, 1 meter square. The other 5 were large iron caskets. She nodded to Ashul.
"Begin," she said. "We are running lean on time."
They started to work on the first block, removing covers from the sockets dotting the sides of the caskets. Incarnus attached tubes and wires to the ports and linked them to the pumps and vials they had brought in the crawler, hissing words to himself as he worked. Miss Madra and Ashul left him to it and began to cut open the welded seams on the 5 metal cubes with compact las cutters. Some of the scavs paused to watch them.
"Better hope this works as it should," muttered Ashul as he glanced at the gangers, "or we're going to have to get creative."
Incarnus was linking fluid feeds and power to the last casket.
"It is them,"
called Incarnus.
"First one is almost conscious. I can feel his thoughts firing."
Miss Madra looked at the horizon. Pale light had crept into the corners of the sky.
"How long?"
she asked.
5 minutes, said Incarnus. "Perhaps 30, maybe 50. As much of a miracle as this is, it is not precise, nor without complications. Their bodies and minds have to reconstruct awareness, humours must rebalance, and nerves have to mesh with muscle. Oblivion must become waking."
"Hope that it is fast and less poetic,"
said Miss Madra, her eyes on the figure that had joined the rest of the scavengers.
"What is all this wonder from beneath the earth, then?"
asked Nis, as he walked towards Miss Madra. His exoskeleton clanked with each step, the feed for the rotor cannon tapping against the frame.
"What you were paid to help us find,"
she replied. "Shouldn't you be watching for wolves?"
"No, they don't come when the light comes back to the sky,"
said Nis. He moved to where the metal cubes and caskets lay on the ground.
"I'm wondering something,"
he said, his voice soft.
"These things are big, serious heft to them. But we ain't got a crawler to haul this weight, and the rest of us, and the gear."
He stopped beside one of the casket-like blocks.
"So I'm guessing that the boxes are just to keep it safe. Must be real valuable to be kept so safe."
He reached out and laid his hand on the metal. Brass digits whirred as they tapped the surface lightly.
"Open it."
"The agreement,"
began Miss Madra. Incarnus was motionless next to one of the caskets. Ashul had faded away out of sight.
"Open it!"
The rotor cannon spun up. Around them, rock drills whined to life, the melter torches lit as the scavs closed the circle around them. Miss Madra nodded slowly. Inside, under her stillness, she began to tense and relax muscles in sequence. She turned her head to Incarnus and flicked a hand at the casket he stood next to. The extra movements of her fingers were unnoticeable to any who were not watching for them.
"All right,"
she said, and moved towards the casket. She picked up a driver and began to pull the bolts from the top of the block. It took a few moments. Nis watched her all the while, the lenses of his eyes altering their focus as he tracked her movements. His tongue was resting between his teeth. The last bolt came free, and she put the tool down and heaved at the lid. It did not shift. She tried again. Nissi's face twitched with impatience.
Grawl!
He said, and flicked his head at the casket. Grawl came forwards, machine arms unfolding from his shoulders with a hiss of pistons. Miss Madra took a step back as Grawl locked the machine arms onto the top of the block and pulled the lid free. Nis stepped forwards and looked down at what they had dug from beneath the soil of terror. A figure lay within. The light from the melter torches and stab lights fell across scarred muscle and a broad face. Tubes led from sockets in its skin.
What?
Nis had time to begin the question before the flechette round hit him in the jaw and ripped half of his face off. The needle pistol and hand cannon were in Miss Madra's hands before the gang boss hit the ground. Grawl twisted, the lid of the casket still clasped in his machine arms. She shot him three times. The first needle hit him in the cheek, the second in the throat, and the last passed between his open teeth as he began to scream. His muscles spasmed as the venom in the needles did its work. He managed to stumble forwards, swinging the casket lid like a club. Miss Madra ducked the blow, came up and put a hand cannon round through his left eye. Meat and torn chrome spun through the air as he slumped into a heap of metal and flesh. She leapt over his corpse, a gun in each hand. The rest of the scavs were halfway between fighting and dying. She saw one with a melter torch and a face of iron take a cluster of flechettes in the spine. He fell, body suddenly a red rag doll with cut strings. She fired as she moved, dodging jets of melter torches and wild lunges. Her needles and bullets drummed out a steady rhythm of death in reply. Incarnus was standing beside the caskets, hands raised. Sparks coiled through the air around his arm, and there was frost on his fingers. One of the scavs swung at him with a piston hammer, froze in place, and began to judder. Blood poured from under the ganger's mask. Incarnus tensed. The frost around his fingers thickened. The ganger turned, legs dragging, and sank his hammer into the chest of his nearest comrade. Blood and bones exploded from the impact. It was over in three more heartbeats. The quiet was as sudden as a gunshot. Miss Madra moved amongst the bodies, checking if any of the scavs were still alive. She ended any doubts with her hand cannon. Ashul appeared from the night, his flechette rifle cradled in his arms. He looked like he had just been out for a stroll.
"Good timing on the first shot,"
Miss Madra said as she glanced at him.
"Hit a little low, though."
"I didn't have time to get my aim straight. You know I work best when I'm not rushed."
"We'll get used to not having the luxury," she said,
and moved back to the open casket.
"Get the others open," she said.
She looked down at the figure in the casket Nis had made her open. Its skin was so pale and still that she would have thought it dead, if she had not known better. She leant in, eyes tracing the old surgical scars and sculpted muscle. A hand clamped around her neck so fast that she did not have time to realize what was happening. Pain exploded through her. Part of her, the part that had been trained to observe and reason even when the rest of her thoughts were broken, knew that the hand on her throat could cut off her air or blood with the slightest pressure. It could break her neck before she could blink. The hand pulled her face down as the figure in the casket opened its eyes.
"Godfrey's,"
rasped a voice. The pressure on her eased a fraction. She breathed.
"Callisto!"
The hand around her neck opened. She fell backwards, steadied herself, and almost vomited into her rebreather. The figure rose from the casket, snapping tubes from the sockets in his flesh. He was a demigod, sculpted in imitation of humanity. Muscles flowed under his skin.
"Mission parameter?"
he asked, as he moved to one of the five metal cubes and pulled its lid off.
"Orpheus," said Miss Madra. "The mission parameter is Orpheus."
The demigod paused for a second, then nodded and began to retrieve objects from the cube in front of him, hands working fast. Sections of warplate emerged and were locked over his body one at a time, then the weapons, ammunition, and equipment.
"A time until strike?"
he asked.
2 hours, 23 minutes.
He glanced up at the brightening arc of light on the horizon and nodded. The figures in the other caskets were stirring too now. Incarnus was moving between them, speaking the code phrases to each of them.
"What do I call you?"
she asked the demigod.
You will call me Fokron, he said.
Bab Bastion, the Imperial Palace Terror. A sculpture of the solar system, carved in cold light, filled Arcamus's eyes as he stepped into the command chamber. A vast, hollow projection filled the center of the room. Within a cone of light, the system rotated, its planets, spheres, its moons, dots, and the reefs and debris fields, washes of light. The projection crackled and flickered as it turned. Tech priests moved around the large hollow projector, their red robes dragging on the stone floor as they made adjustments and clicked to each other in machine cant. Smaller hollow projectors and picked screen stacks filled the rest of the chamber, each a cluster of quiet activity. Men and women in the uniforms of Solar Auxiliar officers talked in low voices, occasionally calling out an order and receiving a reply. Beside them, servitors twitched in their cradles as they performed their functions. Images of orbital defences glowed in the air above them. The room ached with static. The chamber was the heart of the Bab Bastion, a place of council and refuge for warlords and tyrants since before the Age of Strife. Now it had become the seat from which the last protectors of truth and humanity looked out across their defences. Whether from here or the Strategium on the Phalanx, the Guardians of Terror had been watching for the first attacker to appear on the horizon since word had come of Horus's treachery. They'd been waiting a long time. Arcamus noted the position of each of the Imperial fists watching over the room. All of them were Huskarls, Rogal Dorn's personal bodyguards, their duty marked by the black cloaks hanging from their shoulders. Each was utterly still, but he knew they would have missed no detail of movement in the chamber.
Saturnalia, he said into his vox.
A click was the only reply to say that he had spoken that hour's watchword correctly, and so would live to take his next step. The word changed at random every hour. It was an old method, but effective. To those who called such measures unnecessary or awkward, he gave no reply. He did not need to. He had one duty, to protect and serve the Lord who stood in an open space beneath the turning hollow ghost of the solar system. Rogal Dorn did not look around as Arcamus approached. The pale light of the projection stole the luster from Dorn's armor and had set shadows in his eyes and the hollows of his cheeks. Quiet radiated from the Imperial Fist's Primarch, like the stillness at the heart of a storm. Arcamus bowed his head and brought his right fist to his chest. Dorn's eyes flicked to him and then back to the display. Whenever Dorn was not concerned with other matters, he came here. Years ago, when the war had first started, the Primarch had a habit of walking the battlements, looking out as his will remade the palace, then Terra, and then the solar system into a fortress. That time had passed. The fortress was long complete, and Dorn no longer walked its towers and walls. There was no respite. Not for the Praetorian of Terror. The solar system was a battlefield within a greater war. While the galaxy burned and the warp shrieked with storms, the heart of the Imperium smouldered with conflict, like a fire teetering on the edge of becoming a blaze. The old divisions in the Unity of Terror creaked under the pressure of fear and ignorance. The rebellion on Triton had been put down, and its horrors kept secret. But there had been others. Waves of panic sweeping through populations who had been unified for centuries, but alone for much longer. Mars was a cauldron of war. Fire wreathed its orbits as the Imperial Fists tried to keep their fingers clamped over the wound next to their heart. The Rebel Forges hurled rockets and mountain-sized shells at Terra. Ships tried to break orbit, sometimes alone, sometimes in swarms that rose from the polluted skies like iron locusts. Only the efforts of Camber Diaz and his blockade fleet had kept the anger of the Red Planet's spite at bay. Then there were the incursions on the outer sphere.
They came without coordination, but without cease. Wild fleets of warships, crewed by men and women who bore jagged marks on their flesh, and who screamed with madness as they went to their deaths. They had begun at the edge of the system in the early months of the war. First a few, and then more and more, until they were striking the outer sphere of defences like rain ringing from a roof. But dangerous though they were, the incursions were claws scrabbling at the gate. The solar system was a fortress, waiting for its final battle. Every night was the eve of invasion. Every dawn, the beginning of another cycle of waiting. It would come. One night, a new star would appear beside the old, and that star would be the light that said Horus has come. It was certain. The only question was when.
Terra is a fortress with two walls, Dawn had once said to Arcamus. The Emperor, my father, stands on the inner wall that is the war of the paths beyond the Golden Gates. We stand on the outer wall that is the solar system. If either wall falls, humanity falls. That is what is at stake. Not honor or rightness, but existence. If we fail for an instant, all is lost.
The realm of Sol burned and bled and waited, and between it and ruin stood the Imperial Fists and the will of their Primarch. Arcamus felt a phantom shiver run through his bionic leg and arm as he watched the fortress of the solar system rotate in the dark. His eye went to where runes marking void battles blinked beyond the orbit of Pluto. With the time it took for signals to travel from the edge of the system to Terra, the ships represented by those splashes of light would have died hours before. Bodies would already be freezing in the void, fires cooling in the wreckage. Arcamus's gaze moved to the count of hostile ships that had tried to breach the solar system's outer sphere.
20, said Arcamus. Fewer than yesterday.
Too many, said Dawn softly, eyes still on the light above.
Did any of them breach the first sphere?
Dawn gave the slightest shake of his head. Arcamus turned his gaze back to the display.
Move the 10th Eagle and Imperial Mercy back from the outer sphere. Best speed for Mars. Command transfers to Camber Diaz.
Yes, Lord,
replied one of the human officers, a veteran Jovian admiral called Su Kassen. Scars ran up her neck, above the collar of her blue uniform. She had commanded hundreds and thousands in her time, and was used to exercising authority. She hesitated.
First Captain Sigismund's forces in the outer sphere will be—
They will be adequate to his task, said Dawn, his voice falling like a hammer on stone.
Then his features shifted. When he spoke again, his voice had softened.
Another surge will come from Mars soon. It will come in the next 20 days, when the solar storm is predicted to break. Camber Diaz will need both the ships and the men, Kassen.
Of course, Lord, said Kassen, and saluted.
Dawn nodded, gave a last glance up at the system map, and then walked to the chamber's doors. Another duty waited for him, and even if Terra slept, its Praetorian never did. 5 of the Huskarls fell in behind him. Dawn turned as he reached the door and looked back at Arcamus.
The vigil is yours, Captain, he said.
Damocles Starport, Terra.
Oh, what now?
Nessegas rubbed his eyes as he keyed the vox.
Doors have jammed shut,
came the voice of one of his sub-prefects. The man was reliable, but at that moment Nessegas would have cheerfully seen him flogged. The temperature in the southern transport arterial lock had dropped to the point that ice frosted the crystal of his cupola. Down on the cavern floor, the militia were still searching the huge ground hauler. Behind that, the bulk of the Hysen cartel crawler sat going nowhere. He had 23 loads backed up, and the flow through the lock was now 86 minutes behind schedule. That meant he was almost certainly facing exile,
most likely to one of the Albion sink hives. He closed his eyes and put all the control he could into his next words.
"Then unjam them," he said.
"Can't, Honor Prefect. All mechanisms have locked. Nothing's responding."
"Keep trying until they do respond,"
he snapped, and cut the vox. He shivered. The cold was starting to get inside the cupola. He would have to try to summon the tech priests again. His first plea had gone unanswered. Behind him, Sucrine hovered, her silence and presence making it difficult to think. He almost missed the first shots. A stutter of flat cracks sounded from the cavern floor. He frowned and leaned forwards to look down, the frost blurring his view. Another stream of cracking noises, then another, and then shouts. Behind him, he heard Sucrine swear. What was happening? He could not... Figures were moving amongst the vehicles. He saw one of them pause, bring something up to his shoulder, and... There was blood spraying from the back of a militiaman's head as he fell, and now he could see the guns in the hands of the figures, and hear the shouts of the militia, and see the flash of lasfire. He felt his mouth opening. Sucrine was shouting into her voxlink. He saw a masked figure drop from the open cab door of the Hysin cartel crawler. Other figures were moving around the vehicle, working controls and turning wheels. They were wearing cartel overalls, but breather masks covered their heads. Cracks appeared down the center of the five cargo sections. His eye caught a figure raising what looked like a section of pipe onto his shoulder. Nessegas had enough time to realize what was about to happen before the missiles struck the cupola and ripped it from the cavern roof in a ball of flame. Debris and fire fell through the freezing air. Smoke billowed up into the air vents leading to the rest of the starport. On the cavern floor, the five sections of the Hysin cartel crawler split open like flowers unfurling to greet the sun. Gas poured from each container, shimmering with warmth as it rose to follow the smoke up and out of the cavern. Northern reaches, the Imperial Palace Terra. The infiltrator moved up through the palace from the door into the underworld. He moved quickly but with care, passing through derelict lairs and then up through seldom-trod paths. He wove past patrol servitors and sensor nodes, following a route held in his mind. The eyes of patrol servitors touched him, but did not see him. In a dank tunnel, running between water cisterns, the ghost met the second of his kind. Both of them paused, weapons and eyes steady on each other.
"Callisto," he whispered.
"Hecate," the other replied. The first nodded once, his weapon unwavering.
"Mission parameter?"
"Eurydice."
The first infiltrator nodded and lowered his weapon. The two moved together in silence, flowing up through the palace's shadows. In a machine shaft, two became three. None of them spoke after exchanging code phrases. How each of them had entered the palace was irrelevant. They had their mission parameter, and that was all the understanding they needed. They flowed on like a breath of wind. Their armor hid the heat of their bodies, and the camellia line bonded to the plates drank light and blurred colors. The armor was slight compared to the type normally worn by their kind, but their greatest protection was their skill in remaining unseen. That skill was sharp enough to see them through the palace's lower levels at speed. Only when they reached the middle levels did matters become more complicated. Patrols of kill servitors increased, but they only slowed the infiltrators. The true danger would come when they were close to their target. Then they would be in the domain of the Imperial Fists and the Custodian Guards. When they entered that realm, they would have to use every ounce of skill and planning to succeed. But succeed they would. Of that there was no question. Up and up the three headhunters went, winding backwards and forwards through corridors of cut stone, folding into the darkness beside a statue of a forgotten tyrant, listening for the sound of foot or breath that would mean danger. On and on, up and up, like shadows, like snakes coiling up the trunk of a tree. Central reaches, the Imperial Palace Terra. The labor brute was exactly where it was supposed to be, and died without a sound. Silonius lowered the body to the ground slowly. He had broken the brute's neck rather than using a blade. Blood was noticeable and difficult to conceal quickly. He dragged the body to the shadow of a pillar. It would be found, but there was no time to hide it properly. Crouched in the gloom next to his kill, Silonius began to strip it. He worked by touch, not taking his eyes from the corridors to his left and right. The labor brute was the same size as him, and wore an ochre robe and a black and white checked hood. A heavy medallion hung around its neck, showing the seal of a regional magnate within the palace. That magnate had done just as his mission instructions had said, and sent the labor brute down to die in a passage beneath one of the palace's main processionals. Silonius slipped the brute's robe on. The cloth reeked. He could smell the brute's vat broth diet, and taste the stims it had swallowed to keep its muscles growing. The smell matched his own. Scent markers had laced the soup of biomatter in the tank he had slept in. The same reek saturated his own skin. With his shoulders hunched and his hood up, he would look and smell like the creature he had just killed. He took the brute's ownership medallion and slipped it over his own head. Last of all, he took the bundle of scrolls the brute had been carrying and slung them over his back. He started walking, feet shuffling and slapping on the flagstones. He passed down a passage, up a flight of stairs, and then out into the crowd streaming down the processional. It was raining. Heavy drops pattered down on the granite slabs and ran along channels into bronze grates. The clouds, clinging to the inside of the roof half a kilometre above his head, swirled in the microclimate's wind. The crowd moved quickly. Menial workers clustered in herds, their clothes hanging from them in sodden folds. Teams of serfs bore canopies of patterned fabric or sheet metal, sheltering men and women of higher status. Groups of servitors moved against the flow, following their functions with blind determination. There were soldiers, too. War bands in personal heraldry clustered around their paymaster, marching ranks of men and women bearing the emblems of eagles, hounds, hawks, and other beasts on their pennants. Silonius took the entire scene in at a glance. His eyes found the imperial fists standing sentinel on the upper balconies above the main walkway beyond the veil of rain. He found the hidden watchers a second later, hunched behind their camo cloaks in the high niches, looking down at the river of humanity through gun sights. There were no custodians that he could detect. That was good. He checked his mental count of time, paused for 3 seconds, and then shouldered into the press. Rain began to soak him. Most of the crowd made way. Some called out to him as he shoved past them, but he did not respond. The labor brutes were mute for the most part, and his silence was expected. The count went on in his head, the beat of the seconds passing matching his steps. A figure rammed into him from the left and almost fell. Hands gripped his robes.
"Cursed fool, get out of the way!" spat the figure.
Silonius saw a flash of a gaunt face and dark beard, and then the figure was gone. Silonius felt the weight of the metal sphere the man had slipped into his hand. Needles snapped out of the sphere and began to jab into his skin rhythmically. The rhythm became a pattern, the pattern information, and the information a new set of memories unlocked in his mind. He walked on, the rain drumming against his skull, the seconds ticking past. 10 paces, and he brushed past a herald leading a pack of felids on silver chains. A metal cylinder was now in his hand. Another 51 paces, a swerve to turn around the statue of a bull, another brush of contact, and another object to vanish beneath his robe. More seconds passed, his steps following a pattern threaded through time and space as he moved through the crowd beneath the gaze of the sentinels of terror. At last he saw a rain canopy of golden fabric swaying above a tracked carriage ahead of him. 6 labor brutes, in robes and hoods identical to his, held the awning up on long poles. Raindrops burst on its shining surface. He quickened his step. Silver mesh screens hid who rode within the carriage. No one noticed as he stepped from the crowd and took one of the poles that held up the canopy. The brute that had been carrying the pole took the bundle of scrolls from Silonius and vanished into the crowd. It was so casual and quick that it was as though it had never happened at all. He passed through the Unity Arch, beneath the guns of the guards and through the sweeps of Auspex fields. No weapons were permitted beyond the arch, and he watched the warbands of the Terran nobility strip their gear under the eyes of sentinels in eagle masks. A lone night war machine stood before the arch, its towering bulk seeming small beneath the gilt pillars. Its cannons hung relaxed at its side, but its head moved ceaselessly, back and forth, like a dog set to watch on a threshold. Silonius looked up at it as its gaze hovered on him for a second and then swept past. Moments later he was through the arch, and another step on his path was complete. The canopy above the carriage was furled as it began to ascend the Anavros stair. No one noticed that one of its bearers had vanished. In the gloom of a side passage, Silonius found the grating in the floor and dropped into the darkness of an air duct. The rest of his equipment came next. He found it a piece at a time, the rounds for his bolt gun in a sump pool, the firing mechanism wrapped in an oiled fabric beneath a tile, the plates of his armour in a dozen different niches. Some of the items had no purpose that he knew. A cluster of metal shards, a silver sphere, a set of metal rings. But he retrieved them all the same. A different agent had planted each item over the last decade. None of them had known of more than one location, and most had been disposed of after they had performed their task. The explosives, melter charges, blind grenades, and haywire detonators came last, pulled from their hiding places and settled into pouches across his chest. By the time he reached the inner reaches of the palace, he no longer wore the robe of a serf. Plates of armour and ballistic fabric covered his flesh. His form was a blur, the substance of his outline dissolving into textures of light and dark. He moved fast, never pausing or hesitating. There was no sign of the custodians, and he could not detect even the slightest hint of their recent presence. That could only mean one thing. The Emperor was absent from his seat of power. For an instant, he wondered where the master of mankind was. He discarded the question. It meant only that his mission was simplified. He paused when he reached the Dome of Illumination. Crouching on a ledge high above the walkway that circled the abyss beneath, he watched water fall from the mouths of the three statues which bore the kilometer-wide roof on their shoulders. The water roared as it struck the vast crucible far below. Above him, dawn light was falling through the 100-meter-wide aperture in the vast dome. The target was close. In fact, it was a few hundred meters above his head. But layers of rockcrete and plasteel meant that he would have to take one of the doors that led from the walkway below. He knew which door he would take, but he could not take it yet. The moment was coming, but it was not here. Not yet.